Danas pričamo o neuronaukama na jedan vrlo interesantan način. Prvi put u našem podcastu internacionalni gost koji se bavi neuronaukama u pitanju je Greg Gage. Ja ću danas raditi intervju sa njim na engleskom jeziku. Pričat ćemo malo o primjeni neuronauka u kliničkoj praksi i o podučavanju podmlatka u vezi sa neuronaučnim tehnikama. Samo kratko o Gregu Gage-u. On je iz Michigana u Sjedinjenim američkim državama je rođen. On je doktorirao na neuronaukama na univerzitetu u Michiganu i danas je deo Backyard Brains programa i također je fellow TED programa koji, kao što znate, TED Talks jedan je od najpoznatijih predavanja danas u svetu interneta. Greg, it's so nice to have you here. I'm very honored that you chose our podcast to share your story and share your scientific knowledge with us. So for the very beginning, I have to ask you, how do you like Serbia and how come are you here?
I am I'm what they refer to as Serbski Zed. Fortunately married. I had to make a very wise choice in my life, and I married a Serbian woman who lives in the Blokovi of New Belgrade. And so when I come here, and we come here quite often, a couple times a year, and we stay for long periods of time, I get to enjoy New Belgrade and sort of partake in the Serbian culture. And so my Serbian is not that great. But I did understand neuronauke, which is neuroscience.
Yeah.
So I just realized when you said that, I know I can add another Serbian word that I know to my list. So
yeah,
with komšinica, pivo, pjeskavica. So I had the neuronauke to that list as well.
So yeah. Cool. So if I can observe your Serbian, you know all the right words.
Okay.
I have to say, yeah. So I'm not worried. You're gonna find your way in New Belgrade, for sure. So can you briefly explain your journey into neuroscience and what is the thing that sparked your interest in this field?
Yeah, it's funny is that my journey is kind of it's a weird path, right? And what I've discovered in my life is that there are no kind of wrong choices that you make. It's just kind of like you kind of collect things about yourself as you move through life, and then often you use a lot of the skills that you learned in these false turns that you went on, right? And so that was my life. I was an electrical engineer at the university, and I got out of school. I didn't really think about science at all. I liked science, and in fact, I would read a lot of science books. But I got a job as an electrical engineer doing circuit boards and making electronics and stuff like that for a company in the U.S. And at some point, I moved with my partner to Europe, and I kind of got into software a little bit over there and was working there. And it was during I was living in Amsterdam, but my home was in like about an hour south, and so I would take the train back and forth. And I had like a stopover in a university town of Leiden, and I saw a sign, and it said like science lectures open to the public, you know. And so I wrote down the dates, and I was like, yeah, you know. And it got to be that evening, and I was like, you know, I'm going to go. I would read, like I read about Richard Feynman. I read these stories about these great scientists. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to go see a talk about science. I want to learn something new, right? So I went to this talk, and I just was blown away by how cool everything was and how these people were just doing these amazing jobs. And what I was doing was kind of stupid. And what they were doing, in my opinion, like they were doing was like super cool. And so because it's in Europe, they had a little like wine and cheese thing afterwards. And I saw one of the speakers, and I came in and asked him, like, hey, man, like, hey, what do you do? What's your job? He's like, oh, I'm a grad student. Like, what's a grad student? And they're like, oh, we do science. And I'm like, oh, I had no idea at this point. So I'm like, holy shit, this is really interesting. Because I just had, maybe the week before that, my boss was trying to tell me that I was a really good engineer, but I needed to really think about my future, because you don't want to be an engineer the rest of your life. You want to kind of get into management. you want to build a team around you. You want to be like, you know, so you can kind of grow your career. And he told me at the, I'll never forget this. He said, you don't want to carry around a toolbox the rest of your life. And I laughed because I have a toolbox with me right now. And I kept thinking like, why wouldn't anyone want to carry a toolbox? Like what? And so then, so I started thinking about that. And I was thinking, being like, well, what career path could I do where you kind of are praised for being a nerd instead of like being told to change to become this other person, right? And so then I meet these graduate students. I said, oh, my God, that's it. I can go into the university and become a professor, and then I can grow at that one. So that's what got my interest in becoming an academic. And so I started in physics. I started, because those were the books I was reading, and they're all physicists. And so I started to go into physics, and I went and toured a couple of those labs, and I found them very snoozers, just kind of like people on a computer. I don't know. It was, they may, no offense to the physicists out there, but I feel like it was, it just didn't seem like my cup of tea, those specific labs that I went to. But during one of the, when I was going to the universities trying to find out what I was interested in, I stumbled upon a neuroscience lab, and I heard a neuron spike for the very first time. And it reminded me back when I was in college, when I heard about electricity and how electricity worked. I remember like, oh my God, is anyone else hearing this? Like, am I in the class? Like, what the? I couldn't believe that there was like these invisible electron holes that were moving around that could actually make things move. And it was like really creepy for me. And I wanted to dive in and learn everything about that. And so I had that epiphany again, watching a rat on this little green screen. He was in a box, like a chamber. And I had an oscilloscope next to it, or they did, and I was watching it. And every time the rat would turn its head a little bit, I heard this popping sound, and I could see the neurons firing. And I just had that, I had that same feeling that I had in college, like, holy shit. And what is anyone else, like, what? And I had no idea. And I realized at that time, I don't know, I was like in my early 30s, maybe. I was like, I just had no idea, like, up until that moment, I heard about neurons, but I never really put, you know, too much thought into it. And so I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I came back to Europe. I quit my job. I moved to back to the States. And then I didn't get into the program, but I was able to convince the university just through kind of nothing but pure grit, like, because I didn't, my grades weren't that good. I was anyway, but I think they felt sorry for me, or I wouldn't let them go. And so I got into this neuroscience lab. So that's how I got into neuroscience, was like through this weird event that happened to me. And so when I started in the lab, we started to, there was a group of people who were interested in going out to schools to talk to kids about science and about neuroscience. And I said, oh yeah, I want to do that. I want to get in on that. And so, because I wanted to tell kids, like, hey, cause like, I think people like me are out there, like people on the spectrum who are so like narrow focused on what they're doing, right? They don't see, like, I remember somebody asked me when I was in college, hey, do you want to stick around to get a master's? Like, I don't want to, like, I figured you would teach. I didn't want to teach, right? No, nothing wrong with teachers, but I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to invent things. And so I would go into these schools with my lab mates, and we would talk about, you know, that if you like Sudoku, or if you, I was trying to think of, like, if you like doing puzzles, then you probably would like science. It's a really cool career. You would ask it like, hey, what grade are you in? Like, I'm in fifth grade, or someone, or sometimes it'd be eighth grade. And I said, hey, if you stick around long enough, you know, you get to 12th grade, you go to high school, you go to 16th grade, you go to college, and then starting in 17th grade, they pay you to go to school. Like, holy, and I was like, kids go crazy. And so I try to get them interested. And we would do things with, like, you know, try to recreate neuroscience experiments in the classroom. And so we would have these jump ropes, and that would be an action potential, and they would, like, have kids spilling out like ping pong balls to be like the neurotransmitters. But it was like not very cool to compare to what we're doing in the lab. I had 81 wires in the rat's head, and they're trying to understand how the basal ganglia. It was really cool stuff, and I wished we could bring that to the classroom. And so one of my lab mates, Tim, came up and said, hey, I have an idea. We can do a poster for the Society for Neuroscience. It's the largest neuroscience conference that there is. And he said, if we could work on a way to record spikes for dirt cheap using kind of the maker movement tools that was happening around that time, we could make a poster around that. And so I said, okay. It was a kind of so we wrote this abstract, and it said, like, you know, a single channel bioamplifier. You know, we're on a self-imposed deadline. You know, like, we have a budget of $100. We're going to try to record a spike using tools that anyone can afford, right? And so we worked on it for the summer and into the fall, and that the conference was in I think it was in DC that year, and then the when you came to our poster, we had some practice because we were doing satirical posters for years, like kind of making fun of our own data or other scientists, mostly fMRI studies. But so we would never present it in a serious way, because if you did, it'd be kind of like a, no, okay, that's really good work, guys. You know, move on. So we had, it was a $100 was the price tag. So we had a whole flip chart with all our receipts on there. We're kind of building up the story that it was the cure for the zombie apocalypse, because if the zombie apocalypse happened, right, it's obviously a neurological disorder, because zombies change their walking behavior, right? They change their feeding behavior. They want to eat brains now. So, like, it's probably a neurological disorder. So all the vendors would have turned into zombies. And so you couldn't rely on Plexon or all these other famous companies in neuroscience. And so you would have to, the only thing you can do is you can break into Radio Shack at night, which was a store in the US at the time, and you could buy some chips, right? And you can buy, and we had a breadboard there with these things on there. And then we showed it with a cockroach. I think it was a cricket at that time. I can't remember. And we showed that you could actually record real neurons from this. And it was just going to be, this is our prototype. We're going to scale it up so you could have a human on this. That was a joke. Anyway, and so we had a big crowd of people. And I mean, this is how fate has it sometimes, that the someone from the journal Nature was walking by. Oh, what's this big crowd of people? And came over and saw these two idiots giving this talk about this thing, about the zombie apocalypse. It had this device that could record from real brains. And so, I mean, people laugh and they think you're crazy and they walk away. But then some people laugh and they stick around and they're like, wait a minute, these guys have done something kind of interesting here, and they've built something. And like, because you always think, and I get this challenge every year with my students, they, like, in science, you get taught there's only one way to do it. It's like this really obtuse, complex way that you do science, right? And the idea that you could just take a little small circuit board and do something like that just kind of blows people away, right? And so anyway, that's the long story about how I got to where I am.
But it's very exciting.
Yeah, no, it's weird. But I said, if it wasn't for the electrical engineering and then the neuroscience and then having that event earlier in my life, all these things had to come together. And it kind of builds this, like, this narrative that kind of helps you guide your way through life, right?
But I have to ask you, you mentioned a cockroach, and now you have a cockroach on your chest.
Yeah.
And I've watched several of your TED Talks, and each time you have a same print on your T-shirt.
Yeah,
so can you explain, please?
This is our, I think Tim took this picture under the microscope, and it was like literally one of the first cockroaches that we cut the leg off of. And so we had this this.
Oh, image. I can see. It doesn't have six legs.
It's missing a leg. So, like, okay. Our original experiments were... so we have about 80 billion, I think 86 billion neurons. So the cockroach has about 100 million neurons, right? So several orders of magnitude less. But if you were to take a little brain slice from the cockroach and prepare it, you put a little brain slice of human and you stain it and you dry it and you put it up on a microscope and you look at it, you'd be hard pressed to tell the difference. And they are almost identical, right? There's slight differences in size. I got in a fight with someone on Reddit the other day about this, but I think for the most part, it's not like our neurons are like 10 times bigger than a cockroach's, right? They're roughly the same size. And so the difference is the number of neurons. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's good, because that means that the cell is almost very, very conserved. And so you can pluck off a leg of a cockroach, right? And so cockroaches are cool.
As you did?
Yeah.
Several
cockroaches
times.
Are cool because they can regrow their limbs. So it's like, it's kind of this green resource that you can kind of use again. And then we can fight back with PETA, because we don't kill our roaches. We just do what they do in nature. They kind of pop off their legs and they're trying to escape. And they regrow them and they eat and they have sex with other... They do a lot of stuff that cockroaches like to do. So we think they're pretty healthy, right? So that gives us this leg. And the other weird thing about roaches is that, unlike in, like if I cut off your leg or if I cut off your arm, it would quickly like the tissue would all die, right? And it dies because, why? Because you need oxygen to get to it, right? But in the cockroaches, they have this what's called a spiracle system. They have these little holes that allows the air to kind of passively flow through it. So you have this leg that's cut off, but it's still breathing because it's got a little hole there. And that, that leg will stay alive for hours and hours and hours. And so you can tick a couple of sewing needle pins and just poke it right through there. And you can actually go touch these neurons and record the electricity that's coming through that. And that's the thing that I saw in the lab that made me switch my career to become a neuroscientist. It was called a spike. So now on your phone or your tablet, you can actually record these spikes and actually hear them. So there's a little speaker on there. You can hear the popping of the, of these neurons. And so maybe that epiphany that happened to me when I was way late in my career, I mean, like, you know, Einstein, it was like the young patent lawyer Einstein is what made the old man famous, right? But it's like I was well past my prime, but I want to make sure that the other kids, if we get the good ones in there first. So, yeah, so you could actually experience. And so, and I remember for the first few years, we would keep track. We had a log of how many kids heard a spike for the very first time. Because it was such a huge, and I've talked to other neuroscientists and they've said, mentioned similar stories when they heard the spike for the first time. So I think we stopped counting after 15,000 people have heard a spike for the first time because of us. And that was like early on in the first few years. But anyway, yeah, so that's what the cockroaches is all about.
So it's basically a perfect model for neuroscience research.
I think so, yeah. It is something that I think, first of all, kids are a little bit scared of. And I think the fear is a little bit in is giving them a little bit more attention, right? So like if something's creepy, you're gonna keep your eye on it. So like that fear is good because you get engagement, right? And also I think people hate roaches. You know, we always joke there are like bugs that we all love, right? We all love butterflies. We all love dragonflies. We get tattoos of them. We get like you know, what you guys have lightning bugs here, these ones that
glow. Of course. Yeah.
So we all love these bugs, right? But for some reason, it's like very close cousin, the cockroach. Everyone will step on it and try to kill it, right? So like the idea of ripping a leg off of a cockroach, people are a little bit more.
It's not that terrible.
Yeah, it's not like a butterfly. And you know, so I think that's kind of good.
Yeah.
But
yeah, good insect for neuroscience. So if I understood correctly while watching your videos, you often refer to yourself as a DUI neuroscientist. Yeah. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, the idea is like, so we try to, so we ask sometimes silly questions or dumb questions, but we'll answer them very scientifically.
Okay.
And we'll answer them with kind of these lo-fi techniques that can replace hi-fi techniques, right? So these... and that's what I was saying. Even this summer, I'm having a hard time with my students, getting them to realize that you don't need to go to the university to get agar. You can just go to get some Jello or get some, you know, some gelatin stuff from the store, mix it up, and try to do the experiment that way. Because, like, think about the kid at home that wants to do this, or like someone that doesn't have a lot of money. And so, just trying to train people how to be creative to be able to do things. So that's the DIY aspect to it. And then the neuroscience part is, so it's kind of like we replicate a lot of experiments. We sometimes create our own. But the idea is that we try to do it in a way that's more approachable. And I think we tend to not take ourselves too seriously, which is something I think a lot of scientists could learn from, right? Mm-hmm. Not to be too pedantic about things. And so... yeah, that's kind of in that phrase is kind of like this is kind of encapsulating this idea of like trying to do things in a very kind of hipster do-it-yourself fashion.
Yeah, and I'm distracted by your toolbox.
Yeah, I brought some things I wanted to show you.
My eyes go directly to it. It looks like a really fun box.
Yeah, see, I brought my toolbox here, and I thought what I'd do is kind of give you and your audience an idea of what your brain sounds like. That's a good starting spot.
Wow, so exciting.
And so, like the cockroaches, I could...
rip up my leg?
You know, I could rip off your leg and record it, but like I said, like those neurons are going to probably die. Or I could, if I could drill into your head, I could put a wire in there, and if I put a wire in it and I put it into an amplifier, I would probably hear... the popping sounds of a neuron, But that's not very ethical, right? I don't think you'd agree to that.
Yep.
So we have another biohack here. And so we have these little stickers. And on one side of the sticker, there's a little bit of a, like a little bit of a gel, and that gel has salt on it. And so the salt allows the electricity to flow up from your body into this little metal sticker that's here. And then I'll put this guy on there. And then
this looks safe.
Yeah, no, this is cool. This is, believe it or not, it actually is human. We actually did get certified that we are human safe.
Oh, that's good to know.
And so what is, so now we got some metal wires on here, and I put one more the reference electrode onto your back of your hand here. There you go. Sometimes called the ground. And then, so now I've got a connection between your body and this metal wire. And so this is what we call the amplifier. And like many things in science, you make it bigger. Like, and so telescopes make distant planets bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Microscopes make small cells bigger. And this makes current bigger. Current that's flowing through your body. And so you have electricity that flows from your brain down to your spinal cord where it synapses there. Synapse is just a junction between two cells. And it makes this cell fire, and it's going to cause your muscles to fire. And so if I turn this on, it's going to amplify the signal that is picking up between these two electrodes here. And as you squeeze your hand now, pump it up the mic, relax, and do it again. Yeah, so that, what sounds like maybe thunder, yeah, that's the electrical popping of the brain.
I feel
activity.
Very strong now.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, and so, you know, this is Serbia, man. You know, you guys are skeptical people, so we have to be able to prove it somehow.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
We are going to open up our little our device here. Okay, and right now it's picking up my voice. But if I plug in our device here, this green line is going to become you. So now as you squeeze your hand.
So
this is the end of, these are the actuators or spikes. And so what I can do is I can set a threshold here and now do it again. We went a little bit more. We'll give me a big pump. Okay, so now what we're looking at is an individual spike. So it keeps easing. What we're doing, we're averaging it out a bunch of times to get rid of the noise. And when you average things out, the only thing that stays there is the thing that's always the same. And so I put a threshold there, which it triggers the voltage.
Okay.
And when you do that, look at that. What is that?
Wow.
That's an actuator. That's what we call a spike. And that's why we call these things a spiker box, because they allow you to see the spike. That's the thing that I saw that switched my life in grad school was this. In a neuron, this is a motor action potential. We get the details. So it's like it's one synapse away from the neuron because it's from your muscle fibers, but it's close enough, you know, and it's a way that we can start to teach students about how the brain works, because now we have the ability to do recordings from the output of the motor cortex. And then you start asking questions about, you know, how do we encode things like and weights? How do we pick up weights? How do we do this type of stuff? Or we could do things like make a brain machine interface. And I brought one of those. If you put this in your other hand,
okay,
and you can unplug this guy. So we're done with this one. So you saw your brain on the computer here. So take this and plug this at the bottom end.
Okay. This also looks like a bug.
Yeah, it's also, but yeah, we have a very buggy theme.
If you push that power button, you...
Yeah. And if you squeeze your hand on this hand, you're going to be controlling that guy. So now you try to set these... Stack these up.
This is so cool.
So this is a brain-machine interface now that you can pick things up and you can drop them by controlling it. So we teach... a lot of classes about what can you do if you can get to the output of the brain, right? You can start. Now you can imagine if you were paralyzed, how useful it would be to be able to amplify the signals of muscles you can control to control robots in the real world, right? So this is a whole field of research on how to do what neural prosthetics, we call these.
No, really. Like, I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated. I cannot focus anymore.
Yeah, I guess so.
So we could...
Wow, amazing. Well, I knew it was such a cool toolbox.
Yeah, magic toolbox. It keeps going on. So then the... So what we could do is like pretty much anything. So we could make it... if we recorded instead of your, you know, EKG, we could record across your wrist, we could record your heartbeat, and we could make machines that can spit out paper, that have your EKGs on there. It's a lot of fun things you can do with the with different types of brain-machine interfaces. And so we also have a headband that you can wear. You can record the EEG from your brain. So it's a super
with a headband.
Yeah, this is where the DIY comes in. And so there's like the Hollywood version of those big head, the things where you have like, you know, 64 leads or 32 leads. This has two leads, right? And so it's just two rivets on a sweatband, and you pop the sweatband on, and then you could like put your electrodes on there, and you can record alpha waves, and you can synchronize. So one of the students this summer is making a sensor so we get the exact moment the light hits your eye, so we could do things like, for example, the it's called the N170 signal. It's a signal that as soon as your brain sees a face, you get this telltale sign. You get a dip 170 milliseconds after the light hits your eye. So we do that type of stuff.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so I can, I've got one more experiment to show you, and then I think we can chat more about science. And that is... if I were to take my brain, so if I take some electrodes on me, and I would record from me, we could do an experiment now that I think you won't soon forget. And that is, I'm going to take one of the, actually, I'm going to take one of your electrodes off you. I don't need to do these.
Okay.
But, I have two back. And then I'll take these ones out. I should take this one.
Okay.
I'm going to hook myself up and I make sure that I have a brain. And then we could, I'll verify it with this guy here. For those keeping score at home, this is called differential recording for biomedical engineers out there.
Okay.
So I can turn this on, and if I want to, I can control. So I'm getting the same electrical input from my brain.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be cool that instead of me controlling the robot, that I could control your brain to control your arm, and that's what this tool does right here. So I'm gonna turn this one off now, and I'm gonna release me from this, and I'm gonna take these electrodes, and I'm gonna put them on your arm. So you gotta give me a high five, and then I'm gonna stick some electrodes here on your ulnar nerve. That's like right there, and right here. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, you remember that green line you were seeing on the screen? That green line is your brain activity, and that brain activity in your motor cortex fires when you want to move your arm. So if you and I were to move our arms at the same time, so if we both kind of go like this, so just kind of give me a pump like this, and so both our brains, and then relax it. So you can imagine, do it again. If you were to record from neurons inside both of our brains at the same time, mm-hmm. they would both be sending the commands crossing over, hitting our spinal cord, and coming around. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to hijack your brain, and I'm going to stick the electricity that's coming out of my arm that I'm recording here, and I'm going to intercept it where your brain would have sent it to the arm, all right? And then I'm going to stick it into... these electrodes here, they're going to amplify that EMG, and they're going to, you're going to see it here, all right, but you're going to feel it down here. It's going to feel a little weird, and then you're going to see it up here. Okay,
so can't wait.
I'm going to plug it in now. So now we are, now that we're connected to things, we are one cybernetic organism, okay? So I'm going to start easy. So I'm just going to go like this, and you kind of, you can even look away, all right? So you look this way, and I'll turn up just a little bit more. Do you feel it yet?
No.
Okay.
I'm very strong.
Okay, I'll try it a little bit more.
Oh.
Okay. So, all right, so I can, whatever I want to, I can move that amp. Yeah, so I'll just do a little quick pops. There you go. So so now you have no control over this. So I'm putting out pretty low. I'm not going to turn you up. By it. So you can look back now. So I think we've convinced you.
Yeah.
So whenever I want to, so I'm recording the output of my motor cortex and injecting it in there. And so what would happen if like I took my other hand
and I made this hand move. I didn't control this hand with my brain, and I just moved it. Do you think your hand would move?
I don't think so.
Okay, we'll find out. That's a good question, because it's, you never know. Maybe passively moving muscles causes, like, you never know. So no, yeah. It's true. You can see there's no lights coming on. But if I do it myself,
oh, okay, wait. Yes.
So now the next question is like, what would happen? So you keep this hand, put this hand out, and you're going to block my hand from moving. You're going to stop it from moving. I still want to move my hand.
Okay.
But will your hand move if I don't move my hand, but if I want to?
Well, I don't know. Let's find out.
So if I can...
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it works.
Yeah. So let's go isometric contraction. So it still works.
Oh, yeah.
Because the command is coming from my brain.
Okay.
And it gets pepped up. So anyway, these are the types of experiments that we've been developing
Very
to kind of
nice.
Teach how the brain works, right? So, but these are kind of more on the electrophysiology side. And lately, because we're scientists and we keep moving.
We need to unhook ourselves first.
I'll give you back your free will.
Thank you. So you were mentioning that all of these experiments are summed in some kind of a book.
Yeah. So yeah, I brought the book here. So this is where we sort of summarize kind of what we were doing today. That's kind of electrophysiology. So insects and human electrophysiology. So we go through all the brain systems, so like from sight and smells and like how do you encode memories, neuropharmacology, about sleep, about all these different types of things. And it's kind of beautifully illustrated with the idea that you sitting at home would be able to, take some little low price equipment and be able to replicate these experiments and sort of not just replicate them, but to also learn how to become a scientist. I think I can't stress enough that science is not like a study, it's a philosophy. The idea of trying to weigh out one opinion over another by looking at data and trying to see if that data makes sense with the hypothesis that you had, is it correct or not, right? I think even in life, even in politics, I think we can learn a lot by what that person's saying, is it true? Is it based upon logic? And can I follow that through to the result that they're claiming, right? And so, so that's what the other thing we try to teach is we will never start with like, well, this is how so-and-so did it, and we're going to do it because of that. So we try to introduce a some weird thing about, about either muscles or about vision or about something, and then try to say, all right, well, what questions can we ask about it, and try to derive the experiments you can do by asking the right questions, and then how do you analyze the results? And there's a couple experiments in there that completely don't work. We had one on the EEG of meditation, and that's one of my favorite chapters because it doesn't work. We couldn't see an effect between really experienced meditators versus non-experienced. It should, right? If you're in a different brain state, you would think, it is a rough hypothesis, that you would see a difference in the brain. So we looked at every aspect of the EEG state. We couldn't see it. Doesn't mean that it's not a real effect. Yeah, that's the brain on meditation, yeah. But just means that maybe the experiment, the way that we asked questions were not correct, or maybe we need to get a tighter group of the same type of meditators. There's a whole bunch of things that could it possibly be, right? But just try to, you don't always get a good answer, right? You sometimes have experiments.
Or maybe a negative result could be a result as well.
Yeah, so that, but what you have right there is that student actually thought those were real waves that were happening, and then we turned out that those were actually her eye blinks from the electrode that she had underneath her eye. So they look like delta waves, but if you do some very careful analysis, you find that it's not. So you're always trying, and that's the difference between science and pseudoscience, right? Science, you're always trying to disprove yourself. And in pseudoscience, you're always trying to prove something else, right?
But I've noticed that it's very, very beautifully illustrated. And I can imagine that a lot of kids would be interested in reading. I know our kids in Serbia are very good in English, but it would be so cool to have it in Serbian as well.
But it's so funny because that's the reason why I'm here is to actually make this in Serbia. So this is a book that we published in the fall just a couple months ago with MIT Press. And when we did the contract with them, they said, hey, Do you want, do you, like, we're going to have the rights to be able to publish in any language around the world. Is that okay? Is there any countries you want to hold back on? And I said, yes, you can publish in whatever language you want. They've done Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese. I said, but I want to withhold Serbia. We want the rights for Serbia. Like, okay, sure, you can have those, right?
No, but you're really Serbian Zet.
Yeah, no, but I was thinking because, like, I just know, and I've been here enough times, and I've been in the education system, and I know I've been to the university, stuff like that, so I know the system pretty well, and I know that MIT is not going to come knocking on the door of the promotion of science saying, hey, we want to do this book with you, right? So I knew that the only way you can get it done is to try to take it on ourselves. And so after the book was published, I came to Serbia right after that, and I met with the Center for Promotion of Science, and we partnered with them and a foundation called the Nordius Foundation, and they were going to translate this book. But we're not just going to translate. This is the cool part. So I'm here for the summer, and what we're doing is, like, you know, every time, like, when you finish something and it's complete and you put it on the shelf, like, you maybe you turn an exam and you come back and I'm like, oh, man, I should have done something different, right? So it's not often in life that you get a second shot to do something. And so this is a second shot for us because now we own the rights for this book in Serbian, so we can do whatever we want with it, right? Mm-hmm. So we decided, we wrote this grant with the U.S. State Department. We said, hey, we want to publish this book in Serbian. We want to bring in some kits for the schools here. We're going to, you know, bring in enough kits so that teachers can have multiple ones of these running. We're going to prepare the books for in Serbian for the classroom. But we want to do more. We want to be able to add a whole bunch of new chapters into this book, because one of the things that was really bothering about this, the book is called How Your Brain Works, and I felt like we talked about a lot of ways information is encoded in the brain, but we never really talked about how the brain really works.
Like, as a whole.
Yeah. How do you experience consciousness? How do you have an informational model about the outside world and your inside self? And so there's been a number of new studies. Science moves pretty quickly, right? There's about a number of new studies that have come out since this book came out. And so we wanted to sort of integrate those into the book. And so, yeah, we have a grant that we worked with half U.S. and half Serbian students. They came together, we partnered them up, and they all are tackling a different problem. And each one of those problems is all about intelligence. Now we're getting into the nature of intelligence, and we're making experiments you can do at home that can even do things that can even suggest that we understand how consciousness physically works. Like, how did it actually come about? And so I'm super excited, and so we're still in the process of it. It still has about 2 more weeks to go. I just saw them off today. We've got some data coming in, so we're doing experiments with slime molds. We're doing experiments with mushrooms. We're doing a bunch of weird stuff, but I think we're getting closer, and we're going to have a few more. The book will be a little bit thicker, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be completely in Serbian, and so.
So how long do we need to wait for it?
Not long. I think it'll be ready in October.
October already?
So when I head back, wow. I'm going to the Marine Biological Labs in Woods Hole. And I spend a month there. And I'm in the day when I'm not at the beach, I'm going to be looking through the data and adding a few more chapters. Yeah, so it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and hopefully in October you're going to visit us again and just present the new chapters. I'm very excited. So I have to ask, what do you consider your most groundbreaking research that came out from your lab or from your team?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm going to take these off for a second. We don't really do a lot of groundbreaking stuff, and we did do some things. So we're kind of, like I said, that's why I say DIY neuroscientists, because we're kind of, our shtick is that we take things either ripped from the headlines, like a brand new paper, which is what we're doing this summer, or we find something that's been lost in the archives of history, right? We'll find an old paper on, earthworms, and we'll kind of give it fresh air in a new setting to do that and kind of talk a story around it. But there's a handful of things that we've done that no one else has done before. And they come around this idea of the stimulation. Like so we made a video, one of the early videos that we made was with a squid. So what I'm, like I said, I mentioned I'm going to Woods Hole next, and actually this week, but I go back to the States. And that's the, known for the Marine Biological Labs. It's a beautiful, famous laboratory that was built in 1888. A lot of famous Nobel laureates have gone through there. The GFP protein was discovered there. A bunch of amazing discoveries, lateral inhibition in the horseshoe crabs. And so I worked with a lot of the researchers there. And there was someone working with squid. So have you ever seen squid? Their skin can like change colors instantly. Their brain is directly connected to their, so they can like flash things and kind of send messages. So we were experimenting like we were doing with your arm by putting hip hop music into the electrodes, and we could play back hip hop music, and it would, and it turns out that the bass frequencies are at just the right frequency that it will make the neurons fire. And what it does, it just makes this beautiful, like, it almost looks like a display of like you would see like in a screensaver or something like that. It's going with the music, and you're like, and it's like, come, oh wow, on. It's like super correlated. So that correlation is causality. Like we're actually causing it to occur. Yeah. So that was one of our very first viral videos, over 10 years ago. But that those types of things is kind of where we live. So I wouldn't say that I'm going to have any theories or laws named after me, because that's not, I think I'm past my prime on that one. And so what I like to do is to kind of like, you know, give a leg up to the people that are doing interesting things. And I'm a curious person, and I know that if I find something curious and interesting, that other people will too. And so I think, so that's what I try to do, is try to find these little nuggets, and we'll go through. And right now, my co-founder, Tim, is like really into doing stuff with plants and recording from plants. So we've done a number of things in the past with Venus flytraps and mimosas. And these are fast-moving plants, and so they have electrical currents just like our neurons do. But now this summer, he's here working on just regular old boring plants that he's getting from like the mini maxi, right? I literally bought a tomato plant yesterday. And if you put the wires around the tomato plant and you put a match to it, you get this beautiful act potential that goes all the way down and is kind of warning the rest. We don't know what the information is yet. We just know that there's information there. And I suspect if we do make a big breakthrough, it's going to be in the plant world or the fungi world. We're also recording from mushrooms this summer, and even from these like single celled animals. Like I'm trying to record spikes from them. It's like this whole thing is completely unexplored. I think plants are absolutely intelligent, absolutely the
fascinating,
fascinating things. And we know very little about how they're actually perceiving the world, right? And so I think there's probably a lot of Nobel Prizes to be had out there. And so who knows? And I feel that's a spot where amateurs could really contribute, right? Because it doesn't take much. And it just takes some creativity and setting up your experiment, getting controls. And I think you could get a paper out that would tell you something about it. And so I think, there's a lot to be done.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of young people are watching us now, and I know you do a lot of education work with children. So what would you recommend for a young person who was interested in science, who is curious as you are, yeah, and motivated to do science? Would you recommend it, or would you?
So I think that's the key. So there's, and I probably would give a different answer than I did back when I was first going to the classroom, having been around for a while. I've noticed.
That's why I asked.
Yeah. So I feel what I've noticed is that in the real world, it's much different than in how we teach it in schools. And it's funny, if you ask, educators at universities, what's the number one thing you're trying to do? And it's like, oh, we teach our students to do independent thinking, you know, to think for themselves. That's what we do at this university. And then if you ask employers, what's the one thing that's missing in all of your applicants? You know, like independent thinking, right? So it's like somehow we say, we all claim that we're doing something and we're just missing the mark, right? So so I have noticed this. And I noticed it a lot in students and in that come from 4.0, like perfect scores, perfect clubs. And to the point where I think when you get to be too perfect, you forget what it's like
to take risks, right? Because in order to get an absolute 4.0 grade, you're not going to take any risks. You're not going to be able to be curious about something else to the point where, like, oh, I forgot to study for that. And so, so I correlate up like really high scores with the not very good scientists, or you have to reprogram them to fail. And so what I like to see is people that are curious about a number of things. And I like, in terms of GPAs, I like the 3.3 to 3.4s because those are the kids that are smart, but they don't care enough to get the full scores, right? They're probably doing that because they're making something, or they're learning to play the drums, or they're they've got other things in life that are going to give them the creative juices and the ability to fail. Like, they've already failed a half the classes, like, to get to 3.4, or not half, but a few probably. I failed calculus twice I failed it, and once I got a C. I went back and took it at the very end of my college career, and still it was Calc 1. I'm still not good at that, derivatives. But anyway, so that's one thing I'd say, and that's not really good advice because I think no parent is going to say, hey, kid, make sure you don't get all A's, right? Mm-hmm. But they should, I think. Or they should at least praise their kids for doing risky things, right? And I think, at least in the U.S., that's one of the reasons why I like coming to Serbia, is that risk has been completely eliminated, right? Kids have no freedom there. So I come here and the kids have a little bit more freedom. They can actually, get hurt sometimes and not have an adult right there. And I think learning that behavior is extremely important. This is how you become good scientists. And if you ever watch a good scientist, they're almost like kids. They're playful. They're curious, and they have passion for what they're doing. But again, does answer your question. So I'll get into the answer now. If you want to become a neuroscientist, this is what I tell students. Stay away from broad degrees as an undergrad, right? And so that means biomedical engineering or neuroscience undergraduate degrees. These are great things to get a PhD in because you'll focus on some area and you'll become an expert at that thing, right? But to say neuroscience is a good one. Like, you've got, like, what do you mean by neuroscience? Like, there's so many everywhere, every aspect from psychiatry all the way to ion channel flow and this one, so it's like, all right, so you're going to sit in on a class, you're going to take one class on ion channels, you're going to take one class on electrophysiology, and you're going to have all this kind of broad knowledge, but not really be able to do anything with it when you get out. So we see a lot of those students, and they're kind of ill prepared to kind of, because they don't understand how to dive into a subject, right? And so I always tell students that are interested in becoming neuroscientists, go out and do it, whatever you're passionate about, and then once you get that, your grasp on that one, then you come to neuroscience, because then you're bringing with you a whole toolbox worth of things that you can then start to attack this thing with. Because, the brain is so complex that no matter which question you're asking, there's going to be, millions of papers you can get out of these things. So it's very curious about these things. Mm-hmm. And so that's the advice I would give, is to stay away from it until you are comfortable where you are in a, I call them the hard sciences, or other people call it that. It's like the physics, the chemistries, the engineerings, the kind of like these STEM fields that can give you a focus on something, and you can, what's called self-efficacy, that you feel that you can do that in your career. And that's one thing I'll say about these students we have this year from the University of Belgrade. Oh my God, they have a lot of confidence, which is cool. And I was asking them today, I said my farewell lunch with them. I was asking them about, don't just sugarcoat them, but what do you guys think about this fellowship that you're going through? They've been there for a number of weeks now. And they told me that, it's great because in Serbia, we get a lot of theoretical stuff, but we don't really get a lot of hands-on stuff at school. And so the one kid said, I was doing some stuff at home and I learned about some Arduino stuff I was doing at home, but this is the first time I got to see a whole bunch of people just like using their hands to build things. And so they got excited, but I was impressed with their basic knowledge, and not just like theoretical knowledge, like very useful knowledge. And so, no, it was cool.
Mm. And it's very motivating for a young person to hear that you don't have to get perfect grades to be a scientist. I mean, because you hear a lot of different voices on this subject.
No, yeah, but look at the people who are saying it, right? The people who are saying it are never the people that are making the changes in the world. Exactly. It's like, we have like this elitism, this idea of...
Exactly what I was aiming for.
We want to be, we only want to have this thing. And like, I'm so glad that U.S. News and World Report thing is going away and we're stopping going to give like trophies to has the least amount, like the highest amount of rejections, you know, and then... so I think... There is a chance that we can rescue this stuff, but it takes someone to stand up and say, you know what, this is not how we want to do things. Right? Yeah. It's hard because it's been so programmed into students that they just want to get that A tick off the box so they can move on, and then they're going to keep moving on, and then their life is going to be over, and they don't realize what they're even doing it for, right? And so that's our job, to got to get them in there.
Yeah. And as you know, this is a psychiatry podcast. So does your scientific work ever intersect with mental health?
Yeah, we're getting more into that now. So it never did. 'Cause like we would give talks a lot. And then at the end of the talks, we would ask, hey, you guys have any questions? And you know, some people would ask some questions about the lecture. But then it always gets to someone started asking about some aspect of mental health.
This is why we made the podcast.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, and you probably are a better expert than me, is that there isn't a lot of, I mean, this stuff is so, we have some very bad theories about how things work, right? And the evidence is getting a little bit better with the new tools that we have with optogenetics, with some of these CRISPR things where you can knock things in and out. But I still say, like, my dad suffered from a pretty bad stroke. And he was alive for almost like 4.5 years. And if he had that stroke in the Stone Ages, I think the doctors could have done the exact same thing they did to him, which was just kind of observe and make sure everything was okay. So we haven't really had these new techniques that you can just come in like, oh man, I had Alzheimer's the other day and I took this pill and it's like, now it's better, you know, like. So I think my feeling is that we need much more basic research. I did read that the, you know, Alzheimer's, I just brought that one up, has a new drug that shows potential of just barely slowing it down, which I guess that's an improvement over something we didn't have before. But I think we need a model first of the brain, and that's the book that we're working on now. It's not our model. This is called the attention schema from a scientist over at Princeton. But I think what that gives us is a framework that we can hang all the experiments that we've been doing so far on to try to get a picture of how this information processing actually occurs and what happens in certain diseases, right? Mm-hmm. Like with ADHD or with dyslexia or dementia or all these. Interesting, but terrible things that happen to people.
Yeah, and you talked about consciousness, which is really very much a psychiatry thing. So, do you have any? Do you know about any new discoveries on consciousness?
Yeah, so that, and I think consciousness has been solved. I don't think it's. I think it's scientifically. We have a very solid model, a model that can make predictions and predictions that you can test. So one of the experiments we're doing this summer is purely on a consciousness model, which to me ties together, like I said, every paper I read in grad school, everything that I thought was kind of like, oh, that's interesting, that's weird, that's how the brain does that. And like mirror neurons or like these phantom limbs or like the idea that you could touch a rubber hand and your hand would feel it, all that type of stuff. It's all kind of weird things the brain does. But now that I've read this paper and series of papers has been going on for about maybe more than 9 years, but this is the body work that I've been reading. And there's a very, very scientific framework that every piece of evidence that exists in neuroscience today points to this thing being correct. And this theory can predict things that you can actually measure. And so one of the things it predicts which is very strange, is that, well, I'll explain it really briefly. I'm not really good at explaining it yet, but the, unless, do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, people at home, like, no, stop. So this theory states that I mean, obviously the brain is made up of information, right? So what's one thing about information? Information is what is the energy? From Big Bang, you have matter and you have energy, the same thing, but they're in different forms, right? And so what is a memory? A memory is energy that presses against matter that allows you to come back later on and see that energy was there, right? So you could write into a tablet, you know, a clay tablet, and you can come back and say, all right, after time, all the winds and stuff like that didn't destroy those letters, so I can still, so that's a memory that's been etched in there. So it's energy pushing on odd matter. So like, so what is computation? The computation is the systematic way of changing memories, right? And so this is the Turing machine. You may have heard of this long piece of tape. And once you have a Turing machine, his theory proves that any Turing machine is the same as any other Turing machine, which means that you can build a computer. You've seen people in Minecraft on YouTube building 8-bit processors that you can like play Doom from fire. And so like, so you have mechanical things. Like, yeah, you ever seen those Plinko boards where you put, they're like little pegboards and you drop things through and you have these little things that will either turn this way and that's a memory, or it will hit back this way. Mm-hmm. And so by hooking up these things in a certain way, you can drop a marble and it will calculate stuff. So just gravity is feeding this. So it's like, and it does the same calculations that a calculator does. It's the same calculator. It's like, so it turns out that information is completely devoid of the thing that's running underneath it. It's either gravity, it's electricity, it's magnetism, it's lasers. And so the idea that you're running on top of that means that you don't have access to what you're running on, right? So that you don't know if you're being processed by a computer or by an iPhone or by like a mechanical device, right? So the process is there. And so that's the first clue. So we have a feeling that we can't describe. We don't describe waves. We don't describe like white as being red, green, and blue, or all the colors of the spectrum. We see it as white. And so, and the reason why we see it this way is because it's information. So we are living as an informational model. And so it turns out that we have a bunch of models running. So we have a model of our body. It's called the body schema. And so we're doing two experiments on that this summer. So the body schema is like it's like a toy model that you have in your brain of your body. And why do you have that? You have that so you can calculate things. So I could calculate without doing it. I could pretend to look at this book, or you could pretend to take your coffee cup and throw it against that wall, and you know if there's a, I don't even know if there's a window there, but your brain knows it, and you could imagine what would happen to that coffee cup if it hit that wall. You don't have to do it, right?
Yeah.
But you imagine that because you have this informational model of your body and an informational model of that cup, and you can do a simulation. That's what you do when you imagine. You simulate that. And so you're simulating this thing. And so,
based on the experience, right?
Yeah, based on experience. So we learn through experience, right? And that experience is built up the model. So what we can do is we can trick the model, right? So you can do some cool experiments. So one of the experiments we're doing this summer is we put a little massager right here on your tendon that pulls on this muscle. Mm-hmm. And if you do that and you close your eyes, you get this illusion that your hand is moving. All right, because it's like this part of the brain sending it back that your arm is moving. That's what it's stretching. It's called a stretch receptor. So you put there, weird, man, and you open up your eyes and your hand's up here like, oh, okay.
So you messed up the proprioception.
Yeah, all right, so that's messing up proprioception, but here's where it gets really cool.
Okay.
Now you have the person pinch their nose, all right? So they're pinching their nose. They can feel their nose being pinched with the proprioception. Now you close their eyes and you stimulate here, and you wait a while, you wait a minute, and then they'll say, whoa, all right? Because like what's happening is that they feel their arm going like this, but they also feel their nose, right? So what does your brain do? Your brain makes a model that adjusts to the information, and it feels like your nose is growing. And so it feels like
you're
Pinocchio. Yeah, and so it's super cool. So we're getting that down. We have a student from the University of Mielitsa,
and she's collecting this data, right? So you can do this, and you can, and we have people say, well, how big was your nose? People are in there and they're doing it, and they're filling it. So you get a different range. Like, I didn't do it that well. Mine wasn't that great, but there is some of the people that we were doing it with were like freaked out, right? Because they're like way on the other side. So there's a spectrum. It depends on how sensitive you are there. So that's one of the experiments. The other one is kind of cool that we're just started building today is you can put your hand into a box, all right, and you have the person close their eyes and you say, all right, point to your hand that's in the box. And so they'll go like, it's right here. Okay, they point right to their hand. And then on top of the box, we put a fake hand, clearly a fake hand. There's nothing on it, right? And then you put a ring on there and you extend the ring into the box, okay? And then the person slips their hand now into the ring. And then you say, okay, close your eyes and point to your hand. They point to their hand, all right? And then you say, all right, just kind of move your finger and just tap it whatever you want. You double tap it sometimes. Sometimes you just like stop tapping and, you know, try to keep a rhythm, but just kind of like convince yourself that this is you, your rhythm going. And then they see this like this thing, right? This like rubber hand doing the same thing they're doing, all right? And then they get this weird feeling. They kind of begin to feel that that's them, right? They have this like this eerie feeling, like, whoa, like I know my hand's in this box, but that's, so then the experiment that we have to measure data, we're scientists, and we say, we close their eyes again, and we're gonna say, now can you point to your hand? And what happens is they think their hand is up here now. It's not up to the rubber hand, mm-hmm. but it floats up almost like 2 centimeters. So they think their hand is here because they're now updating the model in the brain of where their hand is. And so, anyway, so you can manipulate this mental image of who your body is, right? So that's cool. And so now
very
the question
trippy,
is very creepy. And so I told you in a scenario about you running a simulation with your coffee cup and throwing it against the wall, right? So that's one of the things that we do with this thing, right? And but more importantly, and why I think it's important that we have a body schema is not for ourselves, but you're running a copy on everybody else that you see. And so you can predict what they're going to do. And so you're running your body image on them. And so if you follow neuroscience, there's a thing called mirror neurons. When you watch another person move their arm, if you look at fMRI studies and the good, the bad, the ugly, everyone's, when they see a hand, everybody synchronizes in the hand part of the cortex because everybody who's watching it is running their body schema on that person in the movie. And so their hand cortex is moving, right? And so then, and have you ever seen a person with double jointed, like their arms can bend or their fingers can go all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
How does it make you feel? You get grossed out.
Gross.
Why? That doesn't make any sense. It's not you. Why do you feel sick when you're looking at it? Feel sick because it is you. It literally is you running on them. And that makes you feel gross, right? And so that's the,
It's like me mirroring them and me feeling gross.
Right, but, yeah, exactly. Okay. And so the same thing with emotions, right? So you have these, you can empathize with another person because your emotions are, we have no way of telling another person. The only thing we can do is run a model, a simulation in our brain of another person. And so that's what we're doing when we empathize with somebody. But here's the killer part. So we're doing that to be able to predict. So the brain is a prediction engine. We make, who knows, countless millions of predictions every second, right? So there's I can't remember where this is from, the Thousand Brains, but he brought up a good point. He said that, let's say tonight you go home and without you knowing that, like I snuck out, you guys are getting a drink. I'm going to go to your house. I'm going to modify your door some way, right? I'm going to put just a little divot on the back of your doorknob and you're going to go home. You're going to grab, you're like, oh, what's that? That's weird. It's like a little piece of like, and so you brought your attention to it. Or if I could just move it a millimeter, you'd come home like, whoa, you know, you would notice that. Or
it's different.
Change the tint, which means that every time, and that's a boring thing, you're just opening up your door, right? Which means that every time, every action you're doing, you're simulating all the things and you're predicting exactly what you're going to get, right? So prediction's key in the brain. That's really what we're doing is we're predicting. So you want to predict somebody else, you better know what their body can do. And so you predict, you run on them. And so now here's the cool part. This is the part that freaked me out. And until I saw it, I didn't believe it. All right. So it's not just enough to predict what a body can do. You want to know what they're intending to do. What are they thinking, right? So the attention, what is attention? Attention is
giving your brain resources towards something particular. We have too many things in the world to be able to react to. So you want to put your attention on one thing. So you can do it.
Focusing mental energy.
Mental energy. So if you put your hand out, and I had like some LEDs on here, and I said, all right, when you see an LED, pick up that finger. All right. And if you did it a bunch of times, you'd have a very slow reaction time because you're attending to all of them. But if I say, only pick up this finger, I'm going to only hit this LED, you're two-thirds faster, right? It's like 200% faster. So it's like incredible. So like it's all of your brain resources are going towards that one thing. You can synchronize with it. So anyway, so that's one thing. And then you say, all right, so attention is important. What our brain is doing is attending. It's attending to things in the world. We might be attending to thinking about a vacation that we're inside of our brain, or we're focusing outwards. So we want to run our model of attention on other people. And so how do we do that? We look at their eyes. And so one of the projects we're doing, we made a little web page that we just have a little, we turn on the camera and we just show you, we track your eyes and we just show you various pictures. And as soon as the face comes up, what do? Your eyes target right to that. You can't control it. Your eyes immediately go there. And so, and then if you ask the question, well, why do our eyes have so much white and so little dark? If you look at cats, don't have it. Your dog doesn't have it. Your dog, you have to really pull it, to see the white. We have it because we evolved to look at each other's eyes so that we can see what they're attending to, because attention is super important. So here's the weird part. Our model is our brain creates a model of attention by drawing a big stick sticking out of the eyes, and whichever way the eyes go, we assume that there's a stick coming out that we can then. I guess the easiest way to model, you have a stick figure with an arrow pointing out of it, right? And if you look through the history, like the ancient Egyptians thought that the eyes projected out, like a lot of young kids think that we have this bias. And even in cultures, the idea of the evil eye, that's this old thing that someone could look at you and cause you badness. Like, it's not possible, right? But we have a mental image of that. So we did an experiment. We're doing one right now that actually measures this. And this is absolutely blowing me away. And so let me see if I can show you. How it works.
What do you need?
I just need a tube. All right. Can you hand me that tube right here? To roll up piece of paper. So here's the experiment. So you take a paper tube and we say, all right, here's the experiment. Paper tube has a spot where if you leave it here, it's going to come back. Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you tilt it too far, it falls forward. All right. So that's it. So you're going to be shown a bunch of tubes. They're going to be like we have two heights and two widths. And your job is just to put it at the angle at which it will fall over but doesn't fall over. It's like the critical angle where it's kind of like, teetering on an edge. Okay. So the person plays the game. And so they have to either go left or right. And then, this is the experiment, we have faces that will either be on the left side or on the right side. And they're just trying to mess with the tube. They're not. And at the very end of the experiment, we ask them, hey, so what were those faces there for? Oh, they were just there to distract me. What was the point of the experiment? The point of the experiment was to see if I get distracted by faces. And everyone keeps reporting the same thing. Mm-hmm. All right. And then you look at the data. And this is where it gets weird. If a face was looking at the piece of paper.
When you say a face, is it?
It's literally. So we draw a box of a real face looking at the piece of paper.
Okay.
All right. The tube of paper. And we tell them, all right, now if you tilt it towards the face, people will push it back a degree push it forward a degree as if the face was physically pushing on it and pushing it back. They have to adjust for it, right? And it's the opposite in the other direction. If the face is over here that's tilting this way, they will tilt it back a little bit more. So either forward a degree or back a degree based upon that. And so you're like, all right, well, who knows? Maybe it's just the image of a face on one side that does it. So then this is why we do all these different types of trials. We have four different types of tubes, and we have left or right side of the face. And then we have one more thing. We either have the face have a blindfold on or not have a blindfold on. And so when the face is blindfolded, the effect goes away.
No.
It's really true. It's really true. So we really do have a mental model of an arrow that can touch you, physically touch you. And so we can measure the weight. So the weight of the arrow, because we know the weight of the tube, because we use a cardboard tube that people would know about. So we know the weight of the tube, and we know the angle at which they touch it, they move it. And so we can measure the force. It's about 0.1 newtons. It's about the width, you know, just like a raisin sitting on your hand, like a slight breeze, very, very small, but it's a real effect and you can measure it. It's kind of weird. And so, so with this model, not a lot of things start to make sense. Like the idea of, you hear a lot of people who have, who are in a hospital and they say, oh man, I could see myself. You're crazy. People are like, oh, that's not true. You know, like, I heard Neil deGrasse Tyson the other day. Oh, we should put a piece, a note up there and see if they can see the note. It won't be there. I'm like, he's not really doing it, dude. Right. I mean, yeah. The question is, why is that happening? Mm-hmm. And it could be that your attention schema, this model, one of the properties about it is its location, because you run your model every once. So you have to know that you're here, but you can also run your model on you and the thing with vanculotrism, you run on the vent. And so like maybe that part of the brain is knocked out. And so you're still attending to things, but you don't know where you are. And so you float above and you're still seeing you in the room. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I think this stuff is pretty exciting.
Very exciting.
and I think it will start to, for example, speaking of psychiatry, like multiple personality disorder, it could be that we have two models and the two models are competing. And so one model will pop up, it'll be there, and the other model can pop back up. And so you can, and that's 100% something that can happen. It does happen in other systems, right? Mm. And so, yeah, I think once you have a good foundation for consciousness that's scientific and you can measure, you can start to piece together a whole bunch of information to understand how the brain works.
Yeah, to break the puzzle. So, I have to ask you. You've mentioned a couple of times that the technology is advancing very fast. How did the advancement in technology help you in your research, and how does it help us understand the brain better? Because if you ask me, it's getting kind of creepy because the AIs in the nowadays.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, the AI stuff for me is obviously it's helping everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And depending, it's like. And the people that are against it are often the people that are threatened by it. It is funny how who it's coming for first, right? The creative folks. We always thought, oh man, I feel sorry for those taxi drivers. They're going to be replaced by robots. But now, like, holy crap, they could do podcasts. Like, what?
Exactly. Yeah, it's like,
I don't like this anymore. no, but same thing with me. Like they write better grants than I do, right? So the this is what I did, absolutely fantastic. I mean, we are on this, we are alive for the most incredible, we're witnessing in real time the transition from sentient beings to sentient machines, right? This model, because it's an informational model, can run on any platform. It runs on birds. Birds have a completely different, they don't have a cortex. They have mostly basal ganglia, but a bird can look at another bird and know that, you know, I put a seed there. But I saw another bird looking at me. I need to come back and change that to another location. So that's theory of mind, right? So that's attention schema,
exactly.
Running on a bird with a completely different hardware. So if it can run on a bird, it can run on us. It can definitely run on a computer. There's absolutely no reason why it can't, which means that we're going to have conscious machines within 10 years, probably even 5 years, depending on how the technology goes. And I actually look forward to that, because that means that you have a machine that knows that if it were to, punch your arm, that it would feel pain, because it will run its model that we'll get the pain receptors in there. It will run its model on me, and it will be more kind to me than it would otherwise. Otherwise, it's just kind of just, you know, ones and zeros. But if you can run that the informational model that gives them that empathy, then I think we have a shot at surviving this this thing that's happening while we're here discussing things, you know?
Yeah. But how did it help your research? It did it? Is it just in writing grants or?
No, I mean, so the course that I'm going to go teach in Woods Hole, the Marine Biological Labs, is called the Methods of Computational Neuroscience. So my background is also very heavily in the technology of understanding computer models of the brain, mm-hmm. one of which is neural networks. And so I've been very closely tied to this field and been watching it kind of at a front row seat since, 2013 with convolutional neural networks and ResNet and all these things, and watching it kind of happen. And I remember exactly where I was sitting during COVID. I read it in July of 2020 about GPT-3, and I read that paper, and I froze because I realized.
I froze too.
when it reminds me of in the early days of COVID, you talked, a couple of people in Seattle have this, and then 2 weeks later, the whole world shut down, right? And so it was kind of creepy how fast that worked. And when I read that paper, I oh my God, this is a couple sick people in Seattle right now, and we're starting to see it right now and that launched all these new things, the stable diffusion, the these new ways of using the attention model, which is what's cool is that the thing about that the big breakthrough, right, was the attention model, the attention schema that works within these neural networks. And so it's absolutely fascinating. And how do I use it? So we do a lot of, it's always been hard for us to make computational neuroscience. It's hard to bring a toolbox out and make someone interested like you were with electrophysiology with computational neuroscience. So it's the challenge has been, how do we do that? And so we have been coming up with new ways of doing this. We have these robots now that are, they're computational robots. So they have.
So can I show you? Can I show my audience the robotic hand?
Oh, yeah,
it's really cute.
This is our DIY one. Yeah. So this is not what we're talking about. This is when we teach kids how to make their own prosthetic hand. So we make them do this. It's a little servo.
Oh yeah.
And they put together. And so when they close their hand, it closes and opens back up again. Right. So this is a.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool. So this is the, we asked me what DIY neuro, this is DIY neuro.
Oh, this is.
Yeah, so the robots we're going to be building are going to have these computational models of neurons in there, and the kids are going to wire them up, and they're going to be able to see how spiking neural networks, how a brain just full of information of spikes, right, can give rise to behavior. So we have a camera acting for the eyes on the front of the robot. We have two wheels acting like the muscles. And then the student's job is to complete a task. Maybe they need to follow you around the room. And so it turns out that with four neurons, two for vision and two for motor, you can wire it up so that when something moves on the left side, you excite this neuron that makes the wheel turn on the other side. So then all of a sudden when you do that, the guy turns, right? You can do that on the other side, he turns this way. If you're in front of it, it just rolls forward. So with four neurons, you can get a robot to follow you around the room. And mm-hmm. so our brain is based on this concept, and when you add more and more complexity to these neurons, you can make it wait till it whistles and then it will come towards you, or you can add these different things in there. And so, yeah, we're kind of using AI to train. Have you ever seen like Boston Dynamic robots, how they could do those flips? So they didn't send those robots out and do flips in the warehouses. They're running simulations. So you run simulations, you run millions and millions of simulations. And so we're building networks of brains through simulations to figure out which brains do something interesting. Let me pop those out. It reminds me of how people do genetic research, right?
So yeah, exactly.
You find the ones that do the things that we want, and then we start to explore them and put them into the classroom. So we're using it quite a bit.
And there is so much pseudoscience in mm-hmm. the world now. So is there any, because we love myth busting here in 2.5 psychiatrists in this podcast. So is there anything that we need to clarify for the public,
yeah.
like using 10% of our brain and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. There was an Onion talk. There was a joke on TED Talks. I actually love it. The Onion had it for a year, but they're brilliant. And it was a guy that came out with this device, and he started giving this speech about how we only use 10% of our brains, but I invented a machine that allows you to use 100% of your brain, and he's building it up, how it's going to change the world. He's like, allow me to demonstrate. And he turns it on,
it just drops to the ground, has a foam coming out of his mouth. He pisses himself, and it's like the end, right? And so like the idea of like you really want to fire your neurons. So I think that comes from the idea that we do have a lot of silent neurons, a lot of neurons that don't fire, but it's like you need some zeros with your ones and zeros. You don't want all ones, right? And so you want to have that's called sparse coding. And so we see that, why do we have an experiment on that? In the earthworm, there's a neuron that never fires. It will never fire until something occurs. When it hits something in the dirt, it has to back up. Then that neuron will fire, and then it causes an event to make the worm move backwards, right? So that's called sparse coding. And so I think what they're reaching at is that there's a lot of silent neurons that are in there, but they're silent for a reason. They're encoding information, and they don't fire until they're ready. But I think the other thing they're trying to reach is that, you know, that humans have more potential than they give themselves. And that's one of the things I like about this attention schema thing, is that you realize you're just like, you are just a story you're telling yourself. And I think that's how psychedelics work. They allow you to reimagine that story, and you see how the pieces will actually fit together in a different way. And you can do that, right? I've never done it, but I think I'd love to do that, but too scared to. But I do think that's how these things work. And I think that's what that saying is, right? That you only use 10% of your brain. Like you can build yourself up again in a different way, you know? And so I think that part is true. I wouldn't want to fire more than than my brain is firing right now, though.
But is there any other nonsense pseudoscience?
Yeah, I mean, like that. I don't know the evidence on the left brain, right brain stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain parts of the brain that do certain things. Like speech seems to be localized on one side.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's true that about the creative side versus the analytical side.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be, but I smell BS in that one. What other ones are there? There's the, does alcohol kill neurons? I don't know that story. I haven't seen the papers on that one, and I'm sure there's a lot of things. I mean, cells don't, like, neurons don't really die that well, right? They die in certain diseases. And maybe alcoholism is a disease that you could actually do that, but I think it's mostly in the liver. I'm not sure if that touches the brain. So there's a lot of things that I'm putting in the skeptical pile of the neuroscience, call them myths, but I'm not so sure. Maybe there's evidence, but I haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm. I can see the right side of your brain very developed. So what's next for you? Well, what's the future of your work?
Yes, I want to. I mean, the idea of, I'm a big fan of what's going on in the AI world, right?
Me too. Yeah.
And I think if we can figure out a way to tap into that, so we've just got another grant funded the NIH in the computational model. We're making an artificial leg that we can then poke and put chemicals on and stuff like that that acts like a real cockroach leg. But I think the next thing we want to do is the same thing that we saw, you know, with that robotic hand that the kids can put together is a way that we can do personalized AI, that we can wear sensors, right, that we can then have the students collect data and then feed their personal data into a machine, run some machine learning on it, have it detect patterns that you want, and be able to then to do something with that. So we did a project in 2021 with TinyML. This is like this embedded AI that you can run on a microcontroller that's low power. It's cool, like a coin cell battery, you can run like an AI for like 6 months that will sit there and send an alarm if it sees a person, but not sees a cat or anything else. So it's like this person, it's like, so that's kind of cool technology, but unfortunately, 2021, which is only 2 years ago, but that's a lifetime for software, right? The software just wasn't quite there yet. It was like really too hard to get our students to be able to do that. And so we're going to start to investigate that. So we're looking at the micro bit. This is the BBC has this embedded controller. So we're looking at ways that we can simplify the AI so that students are going to be able to do personalized projects. And so the projects we did before, we had someone that wanted a lie detector, and so they would hook people up and record their EKGs and their skin galvanometers while playing poker, and then when they would measure what they bet versus what they had, and they could see if they could get like predict patterns in that, right? And so, and then we had just other little projects. This one called the
the SSVEP. It's like you put an EEG on, you look at these cards, and you flash the cards at different frequencies, and they can pick out pretty easily which card you're looking at. So it's kind of neat little stuff. I think there's a lot of creativity there. And then what I like about science is the creativity, and I like tools that allow students to be creative. And I think we just give you a toolbox and give you some examples, but what comes, like what you put out there comes back tenfold and better ideas, right? So that's what I'm looking forward to, is like I just can't stop playing with these new models, right? And these LoRAs, these new things are absolutely blowing me away that you can, yeah. And that is a shout out to the open source community, right? So this, you had these Googles had all these companies investing billions and billions and billions of dollars to build these huge models, right? And then Meta let one of theirs leaked, and then the open source community had it, and they found much better ways to build these things. And that made the famous letter from Google about 6 weeks ago, that we have no moat. They realized that, oh my God, we're spending all this money, we're losing the game to these open source people. And so, yeah, I think it's we're in for a wild ride, because if it does get to the hands of everybody, then it gets in the hands of everybody, meaning everybody, right? So, it's definitely an interesting area. Keep your eyes peeled. I'm sure there's going to be much more that we could talk about even in October that haven't happened in.
Exactly, exactly. It's very exciting. But the thing I love the most is how you take some things that are pretty commonly known and pretty researched, and you turn it into something else and something approachable and something DUI. And I really enjoyed your presentation of all of your experience. So while we wait for the book, are there any other books or any other movies or series that you would recommend to our audience? Just regular segment of our show. At the end of the show, we always recommend something.
Sure. I think there's the book that I would recommend to people is the stuff that I'm reading right now.
Okay.
So for AI, I would recommend Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark. And the book on the attention theory is by a guy at Princeton, Granzano is his last name. And he has a new theory for consciousness. It came out in like 2020, maybe 2019. Absolutely will blow you away with how well that theory sticks together and matches all the data you've ever seen. So it's those two things alone, I think, are cool, because those are both leading towards the same thing, right? Towards machines that are going to start taking over. So
yeah. So Greg, I have to thank you so much for being our guest. It was a very, very interesting episode. And while we wait for the How Your Brain Works in Serbian, and for your next appearance here in our show, we're very looking forward to it. So I'm going to switch to Serbian just to...
In October, I'll be able to listen better. Okay.
Yeah, sure. Ljudi, ovo je bila još jedna vrlo uzbudljiva epizoda 2.5 psihijatra. Nadam se da ste uživali koliko sam i ja, i bio sam vrlo šokiran nekim stvarima koje sam video danas. Hvala vam što ste bili uz nas. Ukoliko vam se svidela ova epizoda, lajkujte, komentarišite. Šta biste još želi da vidite vi, pošto ćemo imati još jednu epizodu posvećenu neuronaukama u oktobru, kao što ste već čuli. Tako da ako imate neke predloge ili neka pitanja, molimo vas da nas obavestite. Do sljedećeg druženja. Ćao!
What? Come on.